Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review, who is also co-author of Heavy Lifting. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Welcome to part five of our six-part, very prestigious awards season, the political awards for the year 2015. Today, we take a good, long, and for the most part, depressing look at the media, and we examine the most underreported, most overreported, and the best story of 2015, Jim. So let's start with underreported, and certainly from a conservative perspective, this is probably the low-hanging fruit to take, but it is going to be the series of videos shot undercover at Planned Parenthood over a number of years by the Center for Medical Research. David DeLeiden was the head of this project, where they infiltrated Planned Parenthood, talked to a number of their top people, including briefly Cecile Richards, but also Deb Nucatola, who famously, while chomping on her salad, said she liked to use less crunchy techniques when performing abortions so she could get organs intact and sell those along to research firms. Then, of course, Planned Parenthood apologized for the tone, but not the fact that they essentially harvest organs. Then there was a big debate over whether they profit or just reimburse. Then we got the lady on the next video saying she wanted enough money from this proposed tissue research company to buy a Lamborghini. Then there was the story of the former procurement technician who actually worked for STEM Express, who witnessed the Planned Parenthood technician tapping on the heart of the aborted child, and the heart would beat, and then they would go in through the face to procure brain. It was just the most disgusting, stomach-churning story. But as soon as the Democrats got their talking points together, the mainstream media decided it was just a heavily edited series of videos, and never once admitting the fact that everything in there was legit in terms of what the Planned Parenthood officials were actually doing and saying. Nothing was really taken out of context. And, oh, by the way, the Center for Medical Research also posted the entire hours-long video every time they posted the edited form. And the fact that the mainstream media would pretend that that was just a partisan story is utterly revolting.
That's an excellent choice there, Greg. You realize that their argument was that those videos were heavily edited, unlike the network news.
Right.
Which, as we all know, shows things in their entirety. That's why the network news goes on for 48 hours every single day. So that's a really good choice. And I thought about that. I went in a slightly different direction. I'm borrowing a bit from my colleague, Stephen Miller, who made a really good point. It's sort of the underreported aspect of a heavily covered story this year. Hmm. The rise of Bernie Sanders. For a long while, it looked like he was going to, you know, he still is Hillary's top contender. People still talking about the possibility of him maybe winning in Iowa and having a good chance in New Hampshire. But Greg, if you'll remember, for quite a few months, the basic coverage of Bernie Sanders was, here's this wacky old man from Vermont who's somehow rollicking crowds of thousands of people. And he's, look at these crowds in Iowa. Look at these crowds in New Hampshire. Look at these crowds as he goes from college town to college town across the country. And he's connecting with the millennials. Look at this enthusiasm. Look at these Birkenstocks, you know. And they kept talking about how popular he was and how enthusiastic. And they never got around to what he was saying. Why were people responding to Bernie Sanders so much? And, well, you know, one of a routine part of the Bernie Sanders stump speech is insisting that the real unemployment level is closer to 10% and that youth unemployment and African-American youth unemployment are close to 50%. Wages are stagnant, right? Well, the core of the Bernie Sanders economic message is we are in terrible times. The Great Recession never ended, which, oh, by the way, about 70% of Americans agree with. Sanders uses this as a pitch for pure class envy and socialism and all that stuff. But everything he paints basically says, hey, Obama's economic policies have utterly failed. And I think while you might say you can quibble a bit here and there with Bernie Sanders, I think his general portrait of a economy that is sputtering at best, and most Americans feel like they're not getting any better, and they feel like it's been years and years since they feel like they're really enjoying the fruits of an economic boom, I think that's pretty accurate. And because that contradicts the narrative of successful President Obama, they can't really look, you know, the media kind of averted its eyes from that. And they really didn't want to get into why people were so enthusiastic about Bernie Sanders and why this was touting so much. It was kind of the underwritten aspect of Occupy Wall Street and these periodic bubblings up of angry socialism on the left is that ultimately the stimulus didn't work and the Obama economy still stinks. And so I think that was the aspect I would argue is most underreported of this. And it just kind of indicates just how selective the media can be when it comes to events occurring that disrupt the narrative.
Very well stated. And yeah, I don't think a lot of people expected Bernie Sanders to rise. And it's been more about the horse race for a lot of the coverage than about the reason he is tapping into people, young people and others along the way. All right, on to most overreported story. And this ties into my choice for underreported, because the argument from the mainstream media, at least from a conservative perspective, was we're not going to cover this. It was heavily edited footage. And ultimately, this issue comes down to a woman's choice. Who cares if Planned Parenthood ultimately is taking the lives of hundreds of thousands of babies a year? Yes, taxpayers should fund it. Let's move on. Nope, nothing to see here. In the middle of this huge controversy, a dentist from Minnesota goes on safari to Africa and happens to claim a lion, who, until the story happened, I had never heard of. Apparently other people had. His name is Cecil the Lion, and Jim, you'd have thought it was the greatest human rights atrocity of all time. There was wall-to-wall coverage. Who could do this? Poachers, you got to put him away and throw away the key. People were protesting his dental office and made him shut down the practice temporarily. There was graffiti on his garage door. The guy was basically treated like Joseph Mengele and whoever else you want to put along the way. And ultimately, I don't even remember what country he was in. Was it Zimbabwe, where he shot the lion? Ultimately, they determined no charges were forthcoming because he hadn't actually broken the law. And ultimately, on the left, the lives of animals are more important than the lives of the unborn, and that coverage of that story proved it.
It's a really good selection there, Greg. I'm trying to figure out some way to work in a Weemaway in response to your comment that he takes the big sleep tonight. But anyway, my honorable mention for the most overreported story of the year was going to be Caitlyn Jenner.
Mine too.
And in fact, really, like, I just got to throw that out there. My top for most overreported story is an aspect of a story. I'm not going to say Trump. Donald Trump is the front runner for the Republican nomination. He led the polls for much of the year. It's not saying that Trump doesn't deserve coverage, but I noticed this cycle, particularly in the second half of the year. Republican candidates and Democratic candidates kept getting asked, what do they think of Donald Trump and the latest thing that he said? So Donald Trump kind of had this like two-level media domination throughout the year. First, you know, some of the cable networks would just cover his speeches live. You know, they very rarely would do that for Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Jeb Bush, any of the other Republican candidates, right? You didn't get that. But then finally, when one of these other candidates would get interviewed, they pretty much were asked, so what do you think of what Trump just said about blah, 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 blah? They weren't asked about their own ideas or agenda. It was entirely setting up as, you know, as Trump critics. But like, so even when you're not, the interviews are, even when Trump isn't being interviewed, and by the way, notice that the media Sunday shows and other media would allow Trump to call in a luxury they don't extend to any other candidate, that basically the other candidates were forced to talk about Trump. The media went whole hog obsessive about every little thing that Trump did. And credit where it's due, Trump played them like a violin. I have a feeling that the saturation coverage of Trump is one of the factors that helped make him a front runner. He knows how to make his interviews lively and different. He doesn't give the same old canned talking points. You know, that's great. But the media had a responsibility to pay at least a little more attention to all the other options. And I think the idea of constantly asking the other Republican candidates to either denounce what he said or take responsibility for what he said or something, there were bigger issues than the last thing Donald Trump said. And just a couple, you know, Sundays ago, Bernie Sanders is being interviewed by George Stephanopoulos. I'm sorry. Bernie Sanders is being interviewed by former Hillary Clinton, Clinton administration appointee, George Stephanopoulos, and former Clinton Foundation donor, George Stephanopoulos, I should point out. But his first question to Sanders is, what do you think about what Trump just said? The first question right after the Democratic debate up in New Hampshire. So I think it just indicates this obsessiveness and this insistence that the entire race be about Trump. And if you're cynical like myself, you think it's because the media thinks Trump is inherently divisive and that the more they talk about Trump, the more people will dislike Republicans, the more they will like Democrats. And I think that's what was going on there. And I found that even more annoying than Caitlyn Jenner.
I would completely agree that that was a huge dimension in the media this year. And I think to some extent there's some laziness there because Trump is a tweeting machine. He's a quote machine. And all you have to do is retweet this and put it up on the screen. And what do you think about this? What do you think about this? That way you don't need to ever dig in anybody's policy details about how they would actually do anything to turn around.
You don't need to know anything to ask that question. You just got to ask, what do you think? You don't need that. You need access to Twitter. That's the reporting tool you need.
That's exactly right. All right. On to the best story of the year now, Jim. And as we've mentioned a couple of times in these year-end awards, not a good year. Hard to narrow in on what the best political idea was. And for best story, it was the same way, because this was a really bizarre year. We've mentioned Bruce or Caitlyn Jenner, however you want to refer to that story, and people deciding they identify as a different gender than they are biologically. We had Rachel Dolezal and Sean King with people identifying as different races than they really are, and just on and on and on. And then you had the major campus revolt here in the last several weeks about safe spaces and making all sorts of demands upon officials for using different terminology, whitewashing history, and all sorts of other things that a generation ago, or heck, even 2 or 3 years ago, an administration would have just said, stuff it. If you don't like it, leave campus. But every administration seemed to be, from Yale to certainly Missouri and others around the country, kowtowing and giving in to all these outrageous demands. So cheers for Dr. Everett Piper at Oklahoma Wesleyan University, who sent out a statement that I think spoke to the way a lot of people were looking at this issue. And he said, "This past week, I actually had a student come forward after a university chapel service and complain because he felt victimized by a sermon on the topic of 1 Corinthians 13. It appears this young scholar felt offended because a homily on love made him feel bad for not showing love. In his mind, the speaker was wrong for making him and his peers feel uncomfortable." He goes on to say, "I have a message for this young man and all others who care to listen. That feeling of discomfort you have after listening to a sermon is called a conscience. If you want the chaplain to tell you you're a victim rather than tell you you need virtue, this may not be the university you're looking for. If you're more interested in playing the hater card than you are confessing your own hate, if you want to arrogantly lecture rather than humbly learn, if you don't want to feel guilt in your soul when you're guilty of sin, if you want to be enabled rather than confronted, there are many universities across the land, in Missouri and elsewhere, that will give you exactly what you want. But Oklahoma Wesleyan University isn't one of them." He closes it by saying, "This is not a daycare. This is a university." Jim, this should not need to be a massive act of courage. Yet in this day and time and the way that our culture is going right now, it's a huge act of courage. And it's about time sanity ruled at least in one little sliver of this debate.
I like that, Greg. I'm kind of picturing it almost as a movie trailer. In a world where the students are revolting, and they're also protesting, too, one man had the courage to stand up for the truth and remind them they weren't in daycare anymore. No, a really good point. Look, you know, when you and I go through these awards, and these all stem from old McLaughlin Group categories,
yes,
we kind of assume that at some point the year we'll have a good story. This was kind of a rebuilding year for good news and good stories. So I'm going to go with a slightly... I'm not saying the news is good. I am saying the refocus in attention is good. Greg, I greatly prefer living in a country that is seriously debating about what to do about ISIS than living in one that is largely ignoring it. And so I think that up until, some might argue, up until the Paris attack, like ISIS was this story that, you know, they were rising basically in 2011, 2012, Syrian civil war, the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq and the kind of the power vacuum in some of these Iraqi provinces. They start building their caliphate, and this has kind of been intermittently in the news since 2011, 2012, increased 2013, beheadings in 2014. But even then, at some point, quote unquote, regular news reasserts itself. The Kardashians do stuff, or, you know, some other Obama executive order or something like that. And look, there's a lot of really important news, but ISIS wants to kill people, and they attempted to wipe out the Yazidi. They're constantly finding new, almost like they're screaming for attention. Oh, you thought beheadings weren't scary enough? We're going to set a guy on fire. Oh, you thought that, you know, here's what's killing gay people. Here's what's killing kids. You know, there's this bloodthirstiness. Somebody else referred to them as like almost a literal demonic army is marching across the Middle East, taking over places we haven't heard about since the Bible. And it was like, B story, you know, page A3 story in some newspapers. It was not front and forefront in the American people's minds. And I think it deserved more attention, and, you know, for better or for worse. Look, it's absolutely awful that the Paris attacks occurred and the San Bernardino attacks occurred. But the result of that, we are now debating it. We are now discussing it. The president says we're taking them on more aggressively in the Middle East. I hope so. Maybe the pace of special operations missions is increasing. We are doing more about a threat that I think was lurking and growing for a very long time. And I hope that the net effect of this is that, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, next year is the best story, or maybe more likely in 2017, the best story of the year is the decisive blows that have been struck against ISIS. We may look upon the late last couple of months of 2015 as the time America finally woke up to the threat of ISIS after Charlie Hebdo, after the beheadings, after all these things that were done in Libya and all across the Middle East. We finally woke up to it and recognized how serious this is, and we are now hopefully doing something about it. So that's my tentative best story of the year.
Jim, excellent choice. Tomorrow, New Year's Eve, the very final awards of our 2015 political season, and of course the most prestigious. So talk to you then, Jim.
See you then, Greg. Take care.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.